Welcome back to 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest has been a leading voice in American education for years. Diane Ravitch has written several books about public education and served as the U.S. Assistant Secretary of Education under President George H.W. Bush. She's a historian of education, currently a professor at NYU. The list goes on and on and on. Her new book, Slaying Goliath, The Passionate Resistance to Privatization and the Fight to Save America's Public Schools. Diane Ravitch, my guest tonight, 720 WGN. Great to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Justin.
Before we start, I was amazed about when we see a historian for public education, for education. Take us back to how this began, public education.
Well, if you go back to the beginning, it'd be back in, let's say, the early 19th century, at which time education was available only to the children of the wealthy. There were a few church schools. But basically, if you're poor, you didn't get educated. You went to work on the farm or wherever you could find any work, and there were no public schools. And it was great invention in the 1820s when Horace Mann decided that it made sense to create a public school system. And he was the leader and founder of public education in America. Others began to think, well, you know, this is a really great idea because if we're going to stay a democracy, everyone should know how to read and
right,
everyone
right.
should know how to write. And so it was a very, in a sense, a simple idea, reading, writing, and arithmetic. And most kids didn't get more than a few years of schooling, and the schooling calendar was wrapped around the agricultural calendar so that kids could help planting and help their families out. But it was during the 19th century that public education was established, and it was considered by the early 20th century one of the great wonders of the world.
Was it controversial? I mean, was it controversial in being established? Was there pushback to the idea of making education public?
Well, there was some controversy, basically around the idea of establishing high schools, because there were a lot of wealthy people who said, why should we pay for high schools? Why should we be taxed so that other people's children can go to high school? So there was a court fight about that in the 1870s, and there were fights over religion because there were people who said that the public schools were too Protestant-oriented, and as long as you're supporting Protestant schools, you should also support Catholic schools. So there were great battles in cities up and down the eastern seaboard about whether Catholic schools should be public supported. But eventually it was resolved that public schools would be separated, that there would be separation of church and state, and that public schools would be public.
It's an amazing story. And I asked, you know, obviously a lot of the themes, even in just telling that small sort of summary of the beginning of public education, a lot of those fights are happening today. I mean, there continues to be this controversy over something that many believe in the entire world is the gem of American society.
Well, I think for most of our history, at least since public education was well established, and that would have been by the late 19th century. So for more than the last 100 years, most people would say that one of the great accomplishments of American society was free and universal public education, because in most nations in the world that had education, it was only for the wealthy, and people had to pay for education. And when public education first started here, there were tuition schools, and then the idea of making all schools free and open to everyone, and of course open to everyone meant mostly open to white kids,
mm-hmm.
but then after the Brown decision, the push was open to all kids. And we still have these battles. They're going on. Almost everything that I mentioned as an issue is still an issue today.
It's in your book. I mean, even talking about charter schools and privatization, school choice, we see a lot of these things thrown around, even in the State of the Union that we just saw. All those issues are the same kind of issues that have been a part of public education's history since the beginning.
Right. And the interesting thing about school choice was that it was associated with the segregation movement. So that in the 1950s, when the Brown decision came down in 1954, the southern states responded to it by saying, let's have school choice. Let's let everybody choose, and the white kids will go to the white schools, and the black kids will go to the black schools. They'll be too terrified.
It's a workaround.
We'll make sure that they're
yeah.
terrified, and that will maintain segregation. So the term school choice, which is now thrown about by the president and the secretary of education, was stigmatized. And for many decades, people never used the term because it was a synonym for racial segregation.
I think a lot of people wouldn't know that, and especially because it doesn't matter which political party you're getting school choices thrown around, even from the last administration. And school choice is considered, those two words put together, there is no connotation to it, but there is.
But that's the history of it, is that when you go back and you look at the reaction of the Southern governors, Southern senators, they were all in favor of school choice, but all for the same reason.
Diane Ravitch is with me. She's the author of Slaying Goliath, The Passionate Resistance to Privatization and the Fight to Save America's Public Schools. I'll take a quick break here. We'll come back more with Diane here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Welcome back to 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman with you. Diane Ravitch is here. She's a longtime leader in public education and is a professor at NYU. She's written several books, including her latest, Slaying Goliath, The Passionate Resistance to Privatization and the Fight to Save America's Public Schools. The first segment, we talked a lot about the history, and it's really just a setup. When did public education, maybe it was from the beginning, but when did public education become political?
I think that you could in a sense say that it was always political because people have always battled over who was going to control the schools. There was a fairly settled idea that public schools should be controlled locally and that states were primarily responsible for public education. And the federal government had a very limited role. In 1965, under Lyndon B. Johnson's Great Society Program, he created a funding stream, Elementary and Secondary Education Act, to send money to schools that were impoverished. And that was the real beginning of serious federal involvement in the schools. But it was understood when that act was passed that the federal government would not tell schools what to teach or how to teach. And Republicans were afraid that the Democrats might control it, and Democrats were afraid the Republicans might control it.
Right.
So it wasn't until George W. Bush became president that the federal government passed a truly intrusive piece of legislation.
This was No Child Left Behind.
No Child Left Behind.
Right, of course.
And No Child Left Behind said, you will have test every child from grades 3 through 8 every year, and there has to be yearly progress. And by 2014, this was in 2002 that the legislation was passed, by 2014, every child in America will be proficient or your school will be punished. This was based on a hoax. The hoax was the so-called Texas Miracle. And George W. Bush ran for office, and this was his big idea, was if he was a compassionate conservative and we could fix the schools by testing every child every year because it worked in Texas. Well, we now know 20 years later it didn't work in Texas. It was a hoax. Texas has mediocre test scores. And every time you hear about a miracle and its education, don't believe it. It's not true.
And you write about it, too. There has the canaries in the coal mine, if you will, have been the teachers. Teachers have recognized that the standardized testing movement in this country, which is very young, I mean, like you said, it was 2004, that quickly that these tests don't mean anything. And they're applying them and making kids go through this. And there are some instances where some teachers just walked out or refused to give the test. We had that issue here in Chicago as well, where it said, you know what, this is not the right kind of test for our kids. As a society, how do we take that? Do we look at that and see that the teachers are our frontline, the frontline soldiers in the fight for public education? Or do we look at that and say, you know what, the president was right at the time that people are getting in the way of truly getting to accountability?
Well, the whole notion of accountability is the way it's practiced with standardized tests is ridiculous. The only beneficiaries of this regime of testing every child every year for 3 through 8, the only beneficiary are the testing companies. They're making billions of dollars. Mm. The kids are not benefiting because we find out year after year the same thing. The standardized tests are normed on a bell curve. The kids on the top half of the curve are primarily white and middle class, upper middle class.
With the resources to be able to.
Right. And, they come from stable homes with educated parents. And what you're basically measuring with standardized tests is family income and family education. And once in a while, you'll find kids who break that pattern. But on the whole, time and time again, the poor kids predominate in the bottom half, the kids who don't have good command of English, and the kids who have disabilities will be in the bottom half. So we are not learning anything.
Yeah, you're one of the most foremost leaders in education. You've served in government. When you're pointing this out, you point it out in the book, but you're pointing out to others, is it just really the lobby of test organizations being able to make money? Is that really what this is all about?
You know, what's frustrating, having worked in Washington, having talked to members of Congress about this, is they don't really care much about education. Mm. They do in theory, but in fact, they don't pay attention to it. So when you tell them that the testing is producing nothing, what I show in my book is we have this one measure. It's called the National Assessment of Educational Progress. I was on the board for 7 years, and it got very frustrating because year after year the results would come in, and I'd say, what changed? Nothing. Nothing changed. The rich kids are at the top. The poor kids are at the bottom. We've learned nothing. And then when it gets down to the level of the school, the teacher administers the test in March, and the results come in usually in August or September. The kids aren't even in the same class, don't have the same teacher.
Yeah, right.
And the information the teacher gets is not helpful. It doesn't say, Johnny needs more of this and Jane needs less of
that. How do you build to actually improve year after year in these tests if they're not having any consistency?
Well, it's not even that they don't have consistency, but they don't give any information other than you got this score and you got that score. They don't tell you where your strengths and weaknesses are. They're a total and complete waste of time. And so when I say that the congressmen and senators don't pay attention, they really don't pay attention to the details. All they know is testing is good, accountability is good, we have to have more testing. And then when you get to the state legislators, they'll say, well, we have to have more tests, and we have to test more often and make the test harder, and the kids will get smarter if the tests are harder. This is all, they're talking like fantasy land. Mm-hmm. The tests are worthless.
Diane Ravitch is my guest. She's got a brand new book out, which is called Slaying Goliath. We're talking about it here on 720 WGN. One of the areas that you really focus on is the privatization of American public education, and at least the attempt. And it continues. We see it through different ways. Charter schools is one that obviously people know about, and a lot of people don't. That might be one of the problems, too. Diane, you talk about disruptors. And when I hear that word, disruptors, I always think of it as a good word for the business community, startups who are changing the way we look at technology or changing the way we do things and patterns. Your version of the word disruptors, a little bit more nefarious.
Right. I was trying to find a way to take away the word reformer, because the people who are out to privatize public education, who want to have charter schools, vouchers, online virtual schools, have the government pay for homeschooling, have all this public money transferred to religious institutions, they're not reformers. In my mind, having studied education reform over many years, reformers are people who want to make the schools better, who want teachers to be paid more, who want to have the schools more integrated, who think of ways to make public education more successful than it is today. But the people now calling themselves reformers are actually trying to disrupt public education in a business sense. They're corporate. I sometimes call them corporate reformers, because they take the corporate lingo and they apply it to schools where it's really not appropriate at all. You really don't want to disrupt.
Well, we hear that
lives all
the time from politicians too, who are running, saying we want to run these schools like a business.
Right, and that's a horrible thing, to run schools like a business. I lived through 12 years of that in New York City, and it just doesn't work. It leads to manipulating numbers, having PR that announces great successes, and the successes disappear overnight. And it's, you know, typical corporate PR. But with schools, what you need is steadiness of purpose, experienced teachers. You need the resources so that children have music and art and band and the opportunity to play. There are all kinds of things that schools need, a nurse in every school, mm-hmm. Social workers. I mean, kids today, I have to say, are in deep trouble. I mean, in Chicago, for example, 90% of the kids are in poverty. These kids have traumatic backgrounds, many of them. In Cleveland, it's about 100% of the kids live in poverty. Mm. Nationally, 50% of the kids
Is it because in public education, the kids that you talked about, that bell curve, have opted out, have gone somewhere else, and now public education is really there to serve people who might be living in traumatic experiences or poor kids?
No, I'm talking about American children. And American children, I mean, despite all the talk about our booming economy, half of the kids in this country, wherever they live, half of the kids qualify for free or reduced price lunch, which is the federal definition of poverty.
Right.
20% of the kids are 21, somewhere around that number, live in dire poverty. So I'm not sure why the economy is booming and kids are not doing well, but that means that a lot of kids are not getting health care, are not getting nutrition, and are not coming to school ready to learn. And these are the deep social problems that are more important than test scores.
Well, that's what we heard. I think we all heard in the teacher strike here in Chicago over the fall, and it was a moment that it wasn't about salary. It wasn't necessarily about the things that we usually will see surround a teacher strike. It was about really kind of looking at inequity and recognizing that there's a real issue right now when it comes to kids in Chicago who aren't of the have-nots, not the haves.
Right. I was just recently in Los Angeles, and they also had a teacher strike, and they were striking for the same issues as in Chicago. They want to reduce class sizes, and they had talked to me about classes that had 40 and 45 children. Mm.
That's Chicago, too, right?
And when you have children who don't speak English, children with handicaps, children with lots of problems that they're bringing from home, and there are 45 children in a classroom and some kids are sitting on the floor, that's insane. Mm. They were also striking because they wanted a nurse in every school. I mean, that's not a very radical demand. I went to school in Houston, Texas, public school. Was not an affluent, high-income school. We had a nurse every day. We had arts every day. Why do teachers have to go on strike to get a librarian and a library in every school? I mean, the fact is that we underfund public schools. And I know that the mantra that we've heard from the far right for years has been that we're throwing money at schools. We are not throwing money at schools. Teachers, for the most part, are not paid as professionals.
Well, let's
and
do this.
Class sizes are way too large, and there should be a nurse and a librarian in every school.
I want to pick it up right there. Let's take a quick break. Diane Ravitch is my guest. Her book is Slaying Goliath, The Passionate Resistance to Privatization and the Fight to Save America's Public Schools. A former assistant secretary of education under President George H.W. Bush, a professor at NYU. Diane Ravitch, my guest here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Welcome back to 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Diane Ravitch is here. Her book is Slaying Goliath, The Passionate Resistance to Privatization and the Fight to Save America's Public Schools. She, of course, one of the foremost leading experts when it comes to education in this country. Served in the U.S. Department of Education under President George H.W. Bush. She's a professor at NYU, has done so much, and the list goes on and on. Diane, I'm amazed. Let's pick it up where we left off, just the idea of underfunding schools. Because you hear this all the time, and the president uses words like failing, that the schools are failing. And you'll hear this all the time. You kind of get it on both sides of the aisle. I don't want to make it just one political side or a partisan issue. How do you push back on that, the idea? Because they'll point to stats and say it's failing. That's why we need charter schools. That's why we need private. That's why we need to put money in different places, because the public education system is failing.
Well, first of all, the public system is not failing. I'd say our society is failing. Our society is failing to take care of its children. We're not investing in the future. We're not investing in children. And we're letting children go without adequate medical care. We're letting young women who become pregnant deliver babies without ever having seen a doctor. I mean, there are so many things that we're doing that are just plain wrong, and they're far more important than test scores. The test scores are a reflection of the larger society. I think if we took care of the children and took care of the families, test scores would take care of themselves. Mm. But we've had policies over the past 20 years, all the testing and now the push for charters and privatization, that have been extremely demoralizing to teachers. And there are teacher shortages all over the country, in part because salaries are really inadequate in most places. As I demonstrate in the book, most states are spending less today on schools than they were in 2008.
How is that possible? Is it that the fight to privatize public education is winning? That less tax money is going to schools because of charter schools and choice and other places? Is that why and how is it even possible that we are underfunding education 10 years after the fact?
Well, it's a fact that we are, and about 29 or 30 states are actually spending less than they were. And most of these, if not all of them, are red states where they followed a policy of when the recession hit in 2008, they adopted austerity budgets, they cut taxes, they cut corporate taxes. That means less revenue for schools. Then when the economy got better, they didn't restore the big cuts, or they restored them in such small measure that it really made no difference. They barely kept up with inflation. But I think the other thing that's been very damaging is that there's been a press, particularly from the far right, to substitute choice for adequate funding. And I've document this in the book, where you have families like the Waltons.
These are some of the disruptors you point out. Right.
What I call the disruptors, the Walton family, who own all Walmart. Walmart's not unionized. They don't want unionized schools, so they like to have charter schools that are non-union. And more than 90% of the charters in this country are non-union. Betsy DeVos, our Secretary of Education, hates public schools, funds vouchers, and funds candidates who support vouchers. And there's a hugely important Supreme Court decision coming up this term called Espinosa versus Montana. Montana in 1972 wrote a constitution where they said all public money goes to public schools. And one family said, but we want to go to a religious school and we think the government should pay for it. That's now before a court that is very pro, they call it religious freedom, but what they really mean is transferring government money to religious schools. If the court rules in favor of the Espinosa family, that could devastate public
That'll
education budgets across the country.
So these disruptors, what do they want? Because you mentioned with the Waltons, they want a non-union school, whatever they want. Well, what is, at the end of the day, is it better education? Is it less taxes? What's at the heart of trying to move away from public education?
Well, what they want is libertarianism. They want everyone to make their own choices. They don't care about quality. They want lower taxes. The Waltons right now are in court in a number of places to lower the property taxes on Walmarts. Now, if you lower the property taxes on Walmart, that's obviously going to hurt public education as well.
But that's where I see, I think a lot of our listeners right now will say, I can understand that correlation. I can understand that you would want, corporations would want to lower the taxes, and in doing so, that would underfund public, because that's where public education gets their money from. That's the whole deal, right?
They don't want to invest in the future. And so they have taken what is the truth. And the truth is our public schools should be far better than they are. And many children, particularly black and brown children, are not getting the quality of education they should. They're in overcrowded, crumbling schools. Mm-hmm. And they're in schools that don't have all the resources that they need. They've taken that truth and used it to sell a lie, which is that the answer, therefore, is to send them to religious schools and to charter schools that are not accountable and that may reject them, first of all, because they have disabilities, may reject them because they don't read English, may kick them out because they have behavior issues, and may close in the middle of the year. I mean, charter schools have a long history of...
That's just happened here in Chicago today.
They open and they close like daylilies.
Yeah.
And there, in some states, there are more charters closing than there are charters opening. So they are like businesses in that sense. You don't expect your hot dog stand or your shoe store to be there forever, but somehow you think your
school
public school is going to
be
there.
Right?
It's going to be a regular presence in your community.
Let me play devil's advocate for someone who lives in Chicago, who lives in an impoverished neighborhood, high violence, and recognizes that the public school, under-resourced for all the reasons that you've stated, is just not an ample... a desired location to send their kids. That would be where a charter school or choice could come in, and a charter school could open up and give them opportunities. And we've seen this. Now, is that is that logic sound? The idea that choice in that form, where someone doesn't want to go because they don't trust the public school.
Well,
does that kind of work?
No, it doesn't work. And the reason it doesn't work is because public schools are supposed to meet the needs of all children, not some children. So if you say, well, we're going to run two different public schools in the same neighborhood, one we'll call a charter, and it can choose the students it wants, it'll be open to everybody, but it'll kick out whoever it doesn't want. So it'll keep the kids it wants, and it'll push out the ones that are not doing the work that they want, who are not walking in a straight line and meeting all of their standards of no excuses discipline. And then the public school becomes the dumping ground. Is this going to make for a better society in the future, or would we be better off having a public school that is well-resourced and that is attractive to all the children in that neighborhood, that has highly experienced teachers, that has classes no larger than 18, that has all the resources that would be available if they were living in a suburb? That, to me, is a far better answer than creating a dual-track system. We already had dual schools in this country, and they were supposed to have been abolished many years ago.
You see public school systems, Chicago is one of them, and you see this in other big cities, I think New York has done this, where they almost create the tracks internally, not get charter schools out of the business. They're just saying, we're going to have magnet schools or selective enrollment schools, where they're doing effectively the same thing, where they're taking students who are high performing out of certain neighborhoods, taking them to the good schools that are resourced and funded, and leaving everybody else behind in an unfunded school. Is that similar in the concept? As these they figured out a way to keep some of the more affluent people in those school districts?
I think that it's similar to an extent, and I don't entirely approve of that. I think that it's wrong to separate out the kids who get high test scores and say, we're going to have a special school for you. I think that I went to a comprehensive school myself, and I went to an untracked school. And I think that you learn a lot by going to school with kids that are different from you, and you may be good in math and not good in history, and the other kids may be different. And I think that's fine. I think that within the school they're going to be kids who will say, well, I'm going to take advanced math. Not everybody's going to take advanced math. Not everybody's going to take physics. That's okay. But I think that the effort ought to be a simple goal called equality of educational opportunity. And when we abandon that, and this is the whole problem with the testing regime, is that it ranks kids, you're the best, you're the worst. The best kids get the highest performing of everything and the best of everything, and the rest will throw in the gutter. And that's not right.
Diane Ravitch is my guest. Her new book, Slaying Goliath, is out now, and we're talking about public education in this country and in this city here on 720 WGN. President Trump and the Department of Education, you saw signals this past month that there is a course change. I don't know if it's a course change, but the idea that charter schools, it doesn't seem like he's interested in charter schools. He had mentioned, he kind of signaled that charter schools, he had pointed out somebody in the State of the Union and said they were going to a failing public school, and now I've got him a scholarship to a private school, and everyone cheered, thinking it was a public school, but it turned out that student was from a charter school. And so they're, and then even doubling down, saying he may not even be interested in charter schools and private. From your point of view, when you see that the president is stepping out of line with some of the issues that are in your book, is that good? Is that bad? Is it in a different direction? Where do you see a president who obviously has a different approach to education as it relates to this book?
Well, to begin with, I don't think President Trump has given 5 minutes of thought to education since he was elected. But Betsy DeVos has spent her entire adult life advocating for vouchers. So the new line that we see, which is vouchers are everything, and it's not going to be passed by this Congress because of the House being controlled by Democrats, the new line reveals the true Betsy DeVos, which is she would like to see billions and billions of dollars available for students to go to religious schools. And the great lie there is that they will have the same choice as rich kids, which is ridiculous because rich kids, their families will spend $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 to send them to an elite private school, whereas the vouchers will be worth about $4,500 or $5,000. And we already know how they work. There have been many studies of vouchers in Florida and Louisiana and Ohio and Indiana and the districts of Columbia. And in fact, the kids who go to voucher schools do worse than the peers that they left behind. And they do worse because the teachers are not as well qualified. In some voucher schools, like in Florida, high school dropouts can be teachers. So, and they're teaching bogus science taken from the Bible and bogus history. So it's really a program to dumb down the American population. Why does she want to do this? I guess because she's a religious zealot. But it's a very scary moment because people who understand what's at stake, which is the future of public education, have to be very concerned. And I think it's also a telling moment for the Democratic Party, because the Democratic Party under Obama and Duncan went the route of charters. Mm-hmm. And I think right now the Democratic Party has realized that this has been part of the Trump-DeVos agenda, that it's part of the school choice movement, and that they've made a mistake.
Well, I was going to say, because it's easy to say, you know, that and you can be partisan and say, okay, I don't like the way that the right might look at schooling. I don't like the way the left is. But in this case, in the last 2-3 administrations, they've all been reform-minded in the way that they put foot forward, saying we've got to fix public schools. But the way they go about it, even Obama, they go about it in a way that most educators are scratching their head.
Well, the important thing,
including you,
the important thing to understand about charters is we now have 30 years of experience. There is today a crisis of corruption in the charter sector, and there's a hashtag on Twitter called "Another Day, Another Charter Scandal." And I could spend another hour with you discussing the charter scandals that have taken place in every part of this country. I mean, charters are among the lowest performing schools in Nevada, among the lowest performing schools in the state of Ohio. They're the biggest charter scandal in our history, just broke about 8-9 months ago in California, where an online charter operator was indicted for scamming $50 million.
Yeah. Is that because there's no accountability? They're running it like a business? This is the same kind of thing you see in business where...
It's because there's no, there's almost no oversight. They chose an authorizers who were 500 miles away, so no one checks the books. And then on those rare occasions when they do check the books, they find out that they're collecting money for ghost students. And almost 40% of the charters that have been funded by the federal government have either closed soon after opening or never opened at all.
If you get rid of the, and this is my last question for you, you get rid of the word reform, right? You mentioned disruptors instead.
It's a corrupt word.
What's next for, is it going to have to be a politician who comes in with a different administration, different policy? How are we far gone when it comes to public education charter and the way that this huge, what seems to be a monster of charter schools and vouchers and choice and public education is moving, and so hard to move it in a different direction. Are you optimistic that it can change? Are you pessimistic?
I think that, well, first of all, I'm optimistic that, as my book shows, everything that these so-called reformers have done has actually failed. Charters have not proven to be a panacea. They, in more cases than not, they failed. They have not closed the gap for black and white kids or for brown and black and white kids. Vouchers have been a dismal failure. So at some point, they have to recognize that their strategies don't work. And there are a whole bunch of other things having to do with punishing teachers. Those certainly don't work. And so it's time for fresh thinking. The status quo is no child left behind, race to the top, all these very punitive, test-driven programs. And the answers are not privatization. The answers are to reinvigorate and revive and rebuild our public schools with the resources they need for the children they serve, and to recognize that the most important thing we can do is to make sure that our children are well-fed and have medical care, and that we have jobs for their parents, and that we build our society. Mm. It's a huge order. I'm not saying this is going to be easy, but we can't avoid root causes, and that's what it's all about.
Yeah. Diane Ravitch, great to have you. Thanks for coming in. I appreciate it. Nice to meet you. The author of Slaying Goliath, The Passionate Resistance to Privatization and the Fight to Save America's Public Schools. Thanks again.
Thank you, Justin.